chapter 6. We're reading from verse 45 unto the end of that chapter. Mark chapter 6, verses 45 to 56. Jesus has just been feeding the 5,000, and he is still with the crowd. Immediately he made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side, to Bethsaida, while he dismissed the crowd. And after he had taken leave of them, he went up on the mountain to pray. And when evening came, the boat was out on the sea, and he was alone on the land. And he saw that they were making headway painfully, for the wind was against them. And at about the fourth watch of the night he came to them, walking on the sea. He meant to pass by them, but when they saw him walking on the sea, they thought it was a ghost and cried out, for they all saw him and were terrified. But immediately he spoke to them and said, "Take heart, it is I, have no fear." And he got into the boat with them, and the wind ceased. And they were utterly astounded, for they did not understand about the loaves, but their hearts were hardened. And when they had crossed over, they came to land at Gennesaret, and moored to the shore. And when they got out of the boat, immediately the people recognized him, and ran about the whole neighborhood, and began to bring sick people on their pallets to any place where they heard he was. And wherever he came, in villages, cities, or country, they laid the sick in the marketplaces, and besought him that they might touch even the fringe of his garment, and as many as touched it were made well.
This narrative that we've just read is also found in Matthew's Gospel in chapter 14 and in John's Gospel chapter 6. And the action or the story always follows the feeding of the 5,000. But the different Gospels provide different insights into the whole thing. And it's wonderful to read all three and see what John includes and what Matthew includes. Matthew includes Jesus walking on the water and then asking, and Peter says, "Can I come?" And Jesus says, "Come," and he walks along to Jesus. But Mark doesn't mention that, nor does John in them. So you get different insights of the same story in different Gospels. The next slide, Jason, please. Matthew and Mark both use the word "immediately." I don't know if you noticed that. As soon as Bruce read, it started off with "and immediately" or "immediately." After the feeding of the 5,000, Jesus takes immediate action. And you might think, why is he taking immediate? And John says, in his version of the story, that those who had been fed wanted to take Jesus to force him by force and make him king. Galilee, in the north of Israel, could be an area of ferment, of rebellion. It was far from the power base down in Jerusalem, and revolutions, that's the sort of area. And you could well see they'd been fed, they thought Jesus was wonderful, let's make him king. Now, Jesus, when he met before Pilate, he said, "My kingdom is not of this world." You know, Pilate says to him, "Are you a king then?" And Jesus says, "My kingdom's not of this world." Jesus has to deal with this situation, which John illuminates, of where they wanted to force him to become a king, and he did not want that. Next slide, please. The devil's temptation of Jesus in the wilderness had been to offer him all the kingdoms of the world, and Jesus had rejected this outright. That was not what God was doing. Maybe the disciples, and they had limited understanding of Jesus at this time, early in his ministry, maybe they would have gone along with this. Not for themselves, I think, primarily, but they would have thought it's really fitting, you know, that Jesus should be honored and respected, and it would be a good thing if he was made a king. Of course, they too would have been had privilege. They too would have had earthly position and importance and prestige, his closest friends and disciples. So I suspect that's why Jesus had to act immediately. He had to get his disciples out of the situation where people were wanting to make him king, because they probably would have been alongside with the others who wanted to make him king at that stage of the. They hadn't fully grasped the what Jesus was on about. Next one, Jason. All of us need to seek or guard seeking honor or power or prestige. One of Shakespeare's plays, which is not a very well-known play, it's Henry VIII, and I don't get. But in it, you have this scene between Cardinal Wolsey, who was the probably the right-hand man of the king at that time, and you'd got the young man coming through, Thomas Cromwell. If you want to know all about this, Val is a real expert on it, right? But in, not in the Shakespeare play, but on the history, she knows all about it. But in the play, this is what Shakespeare writes, and it's Wolsey, and he's speaking to Cromwell. And he says, Cromwell, I charge thee, fling away ambition. By that sin fell the angels. How can men then, the image of their maker, hope to win by it? I think Shakespeare got it, didn't he? He's saying, if you're going to follow God, you've got to fling away that sort of ambition, because that was the sin of the angels who rebelled against God. They'd got this ambition. High position or honor or prestige may be gifted to Christians. They may become, as I've written here, advisors or consultants to kings or presidents or prime ministers. I read in some magazine that was given out free that Donald Trump has got a group of, 20 evangelical Christians to be on his board of advisors. Well, I think that that's some hope anyway, isn't it? But yes, praise God for it. But what we mustn't do is be seeking prestige or honor. Sometimes it may be given to certain Christians, and it's very good, but not to seek it. The guard needs to be against seeking position. We've got to stop devoting our lives to reaching the top of the tree. Of course we are to do everything to the best of our ability, whatever you are. Whether you're a school teacher or a nurse or a dentist or a doctor, of course you've got to want to do to the best of your ability and to do good work, whatever your thing. I spent a lot of my life with people who dug trenches in the earth, when we laid pipes. And whatever they did, you could see the good workmen, and we are to be good workmen. But our heart hasn't to be that we're doing good work because we want to get higher and get more position. Our motives for this must never be so that we can obtain power. I can remember years ago when I was in charge of a gang, one of the men was put into prison, and I was really concerned. He'd been one of my team, and then I read in the newspapers what he had done to people, and I realized, yeah, he ought to be in prison. And I was a very junior engineer in those days. This is not of real importance. But 10 years later, I was in a different area on a construction site. And who should be there but this guy who'd been in prison? And he said to me, Mr. Pharaoh, haven't you done well? I didn't ever seek to do well, just to... Sometimes, of course, we will have people who will do very well. But never, never let it be the devotion of our heart, because that way the enemy can get hold of us. The next slide, please. Jesus said, seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. Now, he's not talking about success and promotion and all the things that men desire and high ambition. But what he is saying is, this is the target of our lives. What we've got to seek first, the kingdom and his righteousness, and then whatever else God adds to you, that will be added to you. Jesus himself deals with the multitude who have been fed. He sends them away. He has sent his disciples away so that they shouldn't be tempted beforehand. He says, you go off, get into the boat and go, and I will be there and I'll deal with the multitude. And he makes sure that the multitude don't get their will of making them king. God's purposes are never served by man's ideas. Only our ideas that we get from God serve God's purposes. We can so often get it wrong by using man's ideas, our ideas, instead of the Lord's. Next slide, Jason, please. It says, Jesus departed to a mountain to pray. And if you look at the times, he was praying from early evening when the crowds were sent away. And it talks about the fourth watch of the night, right, in the thing. The fourth watch of the night by Roman time was 3 a.m. to 6 a.m. So Jesus was praying probably from about, I think it got dark at about 6 o'clock at that time. Say from 6 o'clock to 3 a.m. in the mountain on his own. I want to say that prayer is both the easiest and the hardest thing you'll ever do. Very easy to pray, that you will be distracted, and it is a battle and it is warfare in praying. I remember an old hymn which said, Satan trembles when he sees the weakest saint upon his knees. If we could have the next slide, Jason. When we pray, the force of evil is against us to cause us to cease. William Temple, he used to be the Archbishop of Canterbury in about 1941. It's a long time ago. And he made this statement, when I stop praying, the coincidences cease. Do you get that? When you stop praying, the things that seem as coincidences cease. Very soon after I'd become a Christian, I was a student. I'd committed my life to the Lord, and I was thinking prayer is important. I don't know if I've told you this story before, but I was walking across the quadrangle, and who should I see coming to me but the head of the Christian Union in the college. And I stopped him and I said, John, tell me how much time you spend on prayer each day. I was a very naive Christian. And he was very embarrassed. And he first of all stood on one foot, and then he stood on the other foot. And then he said, sometimes I spend an hour. But he was very glad to part from me. I hadn't read the text. If you want to humble a man, ask him about his prayer life. And I didn't know that at that time. I was a genuine, naive, innocent Christian asking. I met him 20 years later in a garden party. Guess what I asked him? Prayer is very, very difficult because you are facing the whole power of the enemy against you. I don't want to be asked how much time I spend in prayer. I am so grateful that there are people who battle and battle and battle and don't give up and keep on going and on going and on going. But it is a tough thing to do. It's sometimes much easier to do when you're in a community of people who are praying, because they stimulate you and they help you. But prayer on your own is really, really difficult. Don't think, that's what I'm saying, it is easy. Of course, you can do it at any time, at any place, or anything like that. But you will face the enemy's force against you. And you will be finding that your mind is wandering and you can't think and you don't know what to pray and you don't know how to pray, and your mind will go on to other things. I'm just telling you what is my experience. I'm like that. I think the initial battle is to allocate the time to pray. use the prayers from the Bible. There is a book that's been published called Praying the Bible, where you actually just take the prayers in the Bible and you pray them out with your heart. That will help you. Use your own words, thoughts. Use the prayers from great Christians of old. They've got an awful lot. If you read some of the things that people who've seen breakthroughs in their lives and what they prayed and how they prayed and the words they prayed, I don't think that everything we have to do has got to be like extemporary, just got to come from us. I think the heart and the motive and everything like that's got to come. But you can use what others have helped. You can certainly use the prayers of the Bible. You can certainly use the prayers of great Christians of old and what they have developed and what they have written, and use them. And use your own thoughts and your own hearts, and seek revelation from the Lord as how you're going to pray. There was a man called Stanley Jones. He was an American missionary in India, and he had an enormous success in India. I think probably in about the 1920s, he wrote a book called The Christ of the Indian Road, which was a book I read and which influenced me a lot when I was younger. And and he said, I don't know if it was in this book, but he did say, if there was one gift that I could give to the Christian church, only one gift, I would give them the gift of prayer. Because he could see just how much was achieved when people got together, when they broke through and they prayed and they prayed. Very conscious of my time. Just hold on. Right, next one. Bruce's version of the Bible, I don't mean it's his version, the version that he read from, had this phrase, making headway painfully. Now, I put that up. My Bible didn't have that thing. But I can remember in the days of Idi Amin, I don't know if you remember him, he was a dictator, brutal dictator in Uganda, probably in the 1970s. I happened to hear a bishop from Uganda who'd come to speak. And he was talking about the work of the church in Uganda under Idi Amin, which was extremely dangerous, many people killed, that sort of thing. And he said, it's like that boat in the ship, making headway painfully. And that just stuck in my mind. That's why I chose the title of this slide. Jesus has sent his disciples across the boat, across the lake by boat. Now, in the text of Feeding of the 5,000, it says, the men sat down on the green grass. The grass in Israel, is in that area, is only green in the spring, after the spring rains. So you can say that it was probably April time when Jesus did this. And April time was round about the Passover, so it would have been quite near the Passover. And the Passover was dated by the moon, by a lunar cycle, right? And it occurred when there was full moon. So when Jesus, these disciples had rowed about 3 to 4 miles, right? Jesus was on the hill. He could see them. And that would be because it was probably full moon, there would be light across the lake, and he'd be able to see them. And he realizes that they're in difficulty. The wind was against them. There were heavy seas. They were struggling to make headway. Next slide, please, Jason. Jesus walks on the water, and it says in the text, and appears as if he is going past them. In their fear, they cry out. They saw Jesus but thought it was not real. They'd left him behind. They thought he was a ghost. And at their cry of fear, Jesus reassures them, take courage, it is I, do not be afraid. Jesus has power over the laws of nature. He's able to walk on the sea. That contradicts Archimedes' principle, for those of you who did it at school. He's able to walk on the water. Jesus has power over nature. When he gets into the boat, the wind ceases. It is a fantastic picture of who we worship and who we follow. He has power over all these things. Next slide. Why did Jesus appear to pass by? You know, why didn't he go straight to the disciples? I think he needed to develop their faith. He needed them to cry out for him. In the text, after the feeding of the 5,000, it says, they did not gain an insight from this. Their heart was hardened. And in the Psalm 95, which at boarding school, we used to go to an Anglican church every Sunday, and they sing that Psalm 95, they call it the Vanity. And one of the phrases, I mean, I could almost recite it as not I could recite it in the Anglican prayer book rather than in Shirley's translation. But one of that is, do not harden your hearts as they did at Meribah. Their hearts were hardened. They couldn't see the insight. And what Satan wants us to do is to stop us having insights about what Jesus is and what he's doing. And so our hearts get hardened, and we need to say, Lord, give me a soft heart. Give me a soft heart for you. Give me a soft heart for people. All the time, keep our hearts soft. Don't let us have calluses and scales on our hearts that we don't see the work of God and way to do it. Jesus needed to develop their faith, and when he got into the boat, the wind stopped. Next slide, please, Jason. People recognized Jesus, and all the sick came or were brought to him. He went to the cities, the villages, or the countryside. People asked if they could just touch the hem of his garment. It's the same as that lady who'd had was hemorrhaging for 12 years, wasn't it? She just wanted to touch the fringe of his garment. It says in this text that all the people, all they needed to do, they said, and all, and this is the text, all who touched the fringe of his garment were healed. As a prelude, he sometimes provoked people. You know the story of the woman whose son was in problems. It's called the Syrophoenician woman. And he said, I'm only really here to serve the Gentiles, really. Not the Jews, and she was a Gentile. And she said, but even the children, even the dogs can eat the crumbs under the children's table. And of course Jesus was going to heal her son. Of course he was going to do it. But he wanted to provoke the faith. And sometimes he wants to provoke. I think that's why he walked past the disciples, or seemed to be walking. He wanted to get their faith to be increased. Where faith was lacking, Jesus was sometimes hindered. It said when he went to a town, I think it was his hometown, and he could do no major miracles because of their lack of faith, though he did heal a few sick people. I think we'd take that, wouldn't we? If we could heal a few sick people. But healing is through the faithfulness of God coupled with somebody's faith. And I want to say, just like prayer is warfare, healing is warfare. You've got to war in it. And I want to give you some... The war is the war with Satan. His aims are disease, sickness, illness at all times. I can remember years ago, many years ago, we had a neighbour who'd got married, I think probably in 1940 or 1941. And she married a man, and they went on honeymoon, and during the honeymoon she got pregnant, the two-week honeymoon. And her husband was in the Navy, and then he was posted to the Far East. And she said she didn't see her husband for 4 years. And in that time, she had the baby, and when he came home, the baby was over 3. And I said to her, wasn't that terrible for you? You know, not seeing your husband, having to bring up this child on your own... And she said, no. She said, it was the war. Everyone was suffering. We were all in it together. My husband returned alive. That is what war is, where you are together in something And maybe we're all suffering, or maybe we're all finding times difficult, but we don't feel sorry for ourselves in it. We keep battling on. I want to tell three stories and see, and then I will conclude, Shirley. Have I got about 3-4 minutes, okay? When I was 18, before I was really committed to Christ, I had a best friend at school, and he was what was called a blue baby when he was born. There was something wrong with his heart. And he had a scar from the center of his chest to the center of his back. And he had been operated upon. And he was normal. When I say he was normal, he was okay. But he couldn't do things like running or... I mean, he could walk and he could talk. And we were very close friends. And he went to a healing meeting. And I remember, now you've got to remember that this is probably about 1960, so I trust the man is now dead who was doing it. He was a man called Brother Mandus. And my friend was at that time training to be a doctor. And he'd got several of his fellow doctors who were in the Christian Union came to this meeting. And they were all criticizing that Brother Mandus didn't speak enough about the cross. But anyway, Brother Mandus went round healing at the meeting. And he came to my friend and he said, do you believe you are healed? And my friend said, I believe I could be healed. No, he said, do you believe? And my friend said, well, I believe I could be healed. And he said, if you don't have faith, you're not going to get healing. Now, I don't think that that is right. I don't think that the lack of healing... Of course it's great that we should have faith, and I believe that all healing in that way comes about with somebody having faith, but it's based on the faithfulness of God, and it's based on other people having faith. Of course it's helpful, but God doesn't say, if you don't have faith, I'm not going to heal you. Sorry, that is my opinion. Second thing, my father. My father got rheumatic fever when he was a boy. And he had a disease that was called mitral stenosis. It's to do with the valves on the heart. And we're talking about 1940, so it's a long time ago when medicine was nothing like advances at present. And he was dying, and there was a bishop in India called Bishop Pakenham Walsh, who he was in the Anglican Church, but he had a noted healing ministry. And my father's family invited him to come and pray for my father. And Bishop Pakenham Walsh came to the town my father was in, laid hands on him and prayed for my father. And my father didn't get better and he died. And I was 3 at the time he died. When he didn't get better at the start, they called for Pakenham Walsh again and said, will you please come again and pray again for him? And he said, no, I've done the praying. I won't do it again. You might say that was a failure, in healing. Third example I want to give you is myself. In the early days of Ichthus, for one Sunday a month, we used to meet in house groups, on the Sunday morning. And Anne and I were in a house group in Beckenham at that time. And after the house group, we were going to drive up to the Lake District for a family holiday in a cottage there after the Sunday morning. And I was... Just before the house group, I was loading my car and the roof rack with the luggage that we needed to take to go on holiday. And I was very lazy, and I was on one side, and I reached over the car, right, to stretch and try and put these elastic straps on the far side of the roof rack, and my back went. And I was in great pain. I could hardly stand up or walk. I couldn't do anything. And Anne said, well, let's just go to the house group, and I'll drive the car. So we got in and we went to the house group. And the house group said, we're going to pray. But firstly, we had a young GP in our thing. Very nice young woman who was a doctor, who was a GP. And she said to me, her name was Mary, just in case. And she said to me, David, I know exactly what is wrong with you. She said, you're going to have to lie down and take rest for 2 weeks and you'll gradually get better. And the house group came round me, and they laid hands on me, and they prayed for me, and I was healed instantly. The pain went. I could straighten up. I could do everything. And we went home after the house group meeting, and I drove the car from Beckenham to the Lake District, you know what I mean, north of Carlisle and all that sort of thing, and or near Carlisle. No problems whatsoever. Do I believe in healing, faith healing? Of course I do. I have a total commitment to it. But what I do believe is that it's a war. And we don't win every case. We lose some cases. But that doesn't stop us. When there are casualties in the war, the army doesn't stop fighting. But we need to keep on being more and more calling out on God. Calling out on God. And I totally believe if we are ill, or if we have relatives or friends or whoever it is, we need to keep on battling in prayer, battling for their health. I totally committed to it. But we do have, and you will all know, we do have casualties. We've seen it. We've seen people that we longed to be healed who've not been healed. But we need to look to Jesus and keep pressing on.